Good morning.
Good morning.
Looks like we have a slightly smaller group. Maybe people thought I was going to do Paul again. I joked with a few people about the fact that Paul is one of the few things I don't teach in Bible back home. I'm basically a narrative guy. Narrative portions of the Hebrew Bible and the Gospels are what I teach. So I'm a little bit off my turf when I do Paul's expository argumentation. But anyway, today, if you did look at the kiosk, you know that we're going to be doing something with the first portion of Genesis, looking at what I consider to be the first of the great cracked pots in the biblical tradition. But because we're doing Genesis, the beginning chapters of Genesis, I brought along as, I'm not going to call it alleged humor, I'm going to call it hopeful hilarity. By the way, just a note on that, I began to realize some years ago that the students back home didn't get my humor anymore. What I thought was funny was not funny to them, and what they consider funny just seems weird to me. Part of it is the difference between their pop culture and my pop culture. But part of it has to do with my area. So much of my humor is in one way or another related to the Bible. And I had a revelation some time ago when I came back from a conference that I had been at in the wintertime, and I had driven on slush-covered roads all the way from Ohio to Valparaiso, and I told my students that by the time I got home last night, my car looked like a car that must have been driven by Lot's wife. And they just looked at me and I, what did that possibly mean? You know, this made absolutely no sense. You know, so then I began to realize, you know, we're living in a very different world, those people and me, and at least in some ways. And there's a theological issue, especially an issue of biblical hermeneutics there. If you understand what the Bible does, the Bible, the way the Bible's truth works is it's a kind of truth that creates a world that you live in. The Bible creates a habitat, the habits of thought in which you live. And the students have very different habits and habitat than mine. But anyway, the hopeful hilarity for this morning is an alternative to one of the stories that we'll look at in Genesis 1 to 11. Some of you have likely come across this because I'm sure, like everything else, it's been on the internet. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth and populated the earth with broccoli and cauliflower and spinach, green and yellow and red vegetables of all kinds, so man and woman could live long and healthy lives. And God saw that it was very good. Then, seeing God's great gift, Satan created Ben and Jerry's and Krispy Kreme donuts. And Satan said, "You want chocolate with that?" And man said, "Yeah." And woman said, "And another one with sprinkles." And they gained 10 pounds. And God created the healthful yogurt, that man and woman might keep their original youthful figures. And Satan brought forth white flour from the wheat and sugar from the cane and combined them. Both the man and the woman went from medium to XXL. So God said, "Try my fresh green salad." And Satan presented Thousand Island dressing and garlic toast on the side. And man and woman unfastened their belts. God then said, "I have sent you heart-healthy vegetables and olive oil in which to cook them." And Satan brought forth deep-fried fish and chicken-fried steak so big it needed its own platter. And man gained more weight and his cholesterol went through the roof. God then brought forth running shoes so that his children might lose those extra pounds. And Satan gave cable TV with a remote control so the humans would not have to toil changing the channels. And man and woman laughed and cried before the flickering light and gained pounds. Then God brought forth the potato, Naturally low in fat and brimming with nutrition, and Satan peeled off the healthful skin and sliced the starchy center into chips and deep fried them. And they gained more pounds. Then God gave lean beef so that people might consume fewer calories and still satisfy their appetites, and Satan created McDonald's. Satan said, "You want fries with that?" The man said, "Yes, supersize them." Satan said, "This is very good." The man went into cardiac arrest. God sighed and created quadruple bypass surgery. Then Satan created HMOs. Something out of a battle. Well, the original crack pot spilling. Oh, by the way, there are a few new people here this morning. I shouldn't presume to go on without introductions. My name is Fred Niedner. I'm from Valparaiso University in Indiana, where I teach biblical studies. And I'm a newbie at Holden. I've been coming up here only since the 90s. Cracked pots overflowing with God's mercy and reconciliation is the theme the theme of the Bible studies growing out of the theme verse. And yesterday we unpacked part of 2 Corinthians from which the theme verse comes. And the way I see the cracked pot, or the clay jars, earthen vessels, these are the embodied carriers of the gospel by which God works reconciliation in the world. And I think this idea goes all the way back to the beginning of the scriptural tradition, and that the earliest cracked pot full of God's mercy was the people of Israel. But you can't really see that even looking at the call of Abram and Sarah in Genesis 12, where God calls them and says, "Go from your land, from your people, from your homes, to the place that I will show you. I will give you a great name, and I will give you all that you need. And by you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed." It's a rather full, rich, and promising, as well as mysterious statement all by itself. But to understand the full riches of it, we need, as usual, to have a running start. So we're going to take a running start through all that precedes, or most of what precedes. So if you have a Bible in front of you, and it would be good if you had one this morning, we'll actually start in Genesis 3, but we'll take a quick look at Genesis 2. It's dangerous to plop down in some of the richest territory of the scriptures and intend to take a flying trip through it. Almost any piece of what we'll look at today could detain us for the rest of the available time. But as most of you know, the book of Genesis begins with the liturgical and rhythmic poem of creation in Genesis 1:1 to chapter 2, verse 4, in which God creates the world in the stages of days, and it's liturgical because it's laid out in a rhythm at the end of which, you know, we hear each time, "And the evening and the morning was the first day, and God said, yes." And you get this response business. God in the first story is off stage. If you did a drama of this, you would not find God visible on stage. You would hear the voice of God and things would appear on your stage. In Genesis 2, verses 4 and following, there is a different sort of picture in which the creation happens as a handmade phenomenon. God, as we talked about yesterday, forms the human being from dust of the ground, and it's the word for making pottery from the materials that everyone used for making pottery. God planted a garden and so forth. So everything in Genesis 2 is God hand manufacturing, making things, including the solution to the problem of loneliness that that God identifies in verse 18. It's not good that the mud creature should be alone. So I'll make a helper as his partner, is what the NRSV says, and we could do 15 minutes just on this. The corresponding strength is what it really says there. So God tries to find that from the other creatures that God makes from the dust, the ones we call animals. It doesn't work, so we have radical surgery on the human being. One side of the human being is taken to make, now finally, a female, and the other side is male. And now at last we have man and woman, not just human being. They were both naked and were not ashamed. And now comes the story that we're going to examine more, a little bit more carefully. Now the serpent was more, the English says, crafty than any other wild animal that the Lord God had made. Maybe some of you know that if you were reading this in Hebrew, the word for crafty there is exactly the same word as the word in the previous verse translated naked. So the last verse of chapter 2 says, the man and his wife were both arum, it is in Hebrew, and they were not ashamed. Now the serpent was more arum than any other wild animal that the Lord God had made. What's going on here is a pun of sorts. There is a word for wise, cunning, crafty, that you pronounce in Hebrew, arum. There is a word, the word for naked is derived from the Hebrew word for skin, which is ur. There are several words pronounced ur in Hebrew, but this is one of them. The derived word naked is pronounced and written with the exact same letters as the word for cunning and crafty. Like, it would be the equivalent of our word LEAD, which can be either a heavy metal or a word to describe what you do when you take someone by the hand and guide them somewhere. Exact same letters, but two totally different words. But it makes for a very interesting pun, because as we know, down in verse 7, the human beings are going to discover after what they do that they are arum. But now the question is, which one are they? At that point, we translate it naked, but as we'll see in the way that they behave, they're also this other thing now. They've discovered something else, and we'll see how they do that other thing, this craftiness thing. They've become like the serpent. They've not only become naked, they've become as crafty as the serpent. And we'll talk about that. But you know, any fourth grader who reads this story knows when God says, don't eat off of that one tree, that somebody's going to eat off of it, because that's just the way it is. You know, if there's an injunction in a story, it will get broken. And so we get Again, we get a conversation here that we could spend quite a long time on. Exactly why do they fall for this? They seem to be wanting something more than what they already have. And they want a certain measure of control over their life and over their experience. And so they fall for this this temptation to have more. And then their eyes are opened, and they recognize their own room. They sew fig leaves together and make themselves loincloths. So their immediate response is to cover up. And then this funny scene. They heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the evening breeze. So God not only makes things by hand and gets dirty fingernails in the mud, God takes an evening constitutional. Takes a little walk in the cool of the day, because you don't want to do it at noon, it's too hot. And the human beings are hiding among the trees of the garden, and so God is looking for them. I mean, God, the way I read Genesis, God creates the human beings because loneliness is no good. That's why there is something and not nothing, because to be alone is no good for anybody, and God knows. And so God has made the human beings now, and God is going to do what God had in mind by making human beings. God's going to have a little conversation in the cool of the day, but where are they? So God has to go looking. Where are you? And from the bushes comes, "We're afraid. We're hiding in the bushes. Hiding. We're naked." God said, "Who told you about that? Did you eat from that tree?" And now we discover more a room. The cunning kind of a room. The stuff I was talking about yesterday, of having to be right. Me. I didn't have anything to do with that. That woman who you made, she gave me this stuff. And the woman says, "Me? Not me, serpent. That ain't my serpent. I didn't put that serpent here. That serpent tricked me, and I ate." So they gotta be right. They can't be the wrong one. They've got to be right. So there's another kind of cover-up going on here. You know why snakes were considered the most mysterious things to the ancient people? Because a snake sheds its skin, leaves its skin behind, and you can think it's one place, and it's actually someplace else. And you never know where you're going to see a snake. They are the sneakiest things. They can appear just about anywhere. All of a sudden, there they are, but their skin was over here. So there's all kinds of stuff going on in the story about skin and hiding and being visible and apparent and not being visible and transparent. So this is another kind of cover-up, blaming other people. I'm right. And if you think this is not about all of us, just ponder all the times you've been late by 5 minutes to some place where you really needed to be on time. Where did your mind go? Whose fault was it going to be that you were late? It was the train, right? It wasn't you. It was the traffic. It was your kid who made you do something before you left the house. It's never your fault. It's always somebody else. Our minds just do that because we're right. It's the other things that have gotten in the way. So this is the story about all of us. This is the world we inhabit. So anyway, God then responds to all of this with a curse. But notice who gets cursed. Not the man or the woman, but the serpent gets cursed. The human being's experience gets complicated. And I suppose you could say that in a certain sense there is curse that lands upon them. But the actual language of curse is reserved for the serpent. And the relationship between the human being and this other creature. The woman will have the complexities and pain of childbirth, and both of the human beings will get to sweat and sweat and sweat as they work and mostly get thorns and thistles and then die. Congratulations, have fun. That's their experience. And then at the end of that poem of curse, the man names his wife Eve because she's the mother of all the living. And the Lord made garments of skins. And there's that word again, a room word, only this time it's a more simple form, the skin. They look pretty silly in those loincloths, so God makes for them clothing. But now if you think about it, already here, somebody had to die. Unless this was Naugahyde, somebody had to die for these people to have clothing and to be covered, for the shame that they brought upon themselves to be covered. So there's a truth of the world in which we live. Somebody always ends up dying because of what happens, even if it's for a solution. But what I want us to notice here, because this is what's going to be repeated in some subsequent stories now, is that we have a pattern that we're going to see repeated. What we just saw in this story is what we'll call for shorthand a sin. That is a violation of a command, but even in some ways worse than that, the taking of control of the world into your own hands. Becoming your own God. Well, God has commandments, but we know better. We'll take over, we'll do what we know is right, regardless of what we've been told. The second step is God makes discovery of what's happened. God comes around and discovers them hiding in the bushes. God responds, with a curse. This time mostly the snake, but also the experiences of the other creatures. But then at the end, we've got a problem now. We've got these people running around a room. And this is going to complicate everything, and it's going to cause even more pain than the stuff that is part of the curse. So God does something that I call a provisional solution to what the human beings have unleashed in the world. Makes them clothing to cover up their nakedness. Okay, so that's the four stages of this story. I know very well that we could stop and ponder any piece of this for another half hour. Any quick questions on Genesis 3? Well, let's look at 4 then quickly. Now the man knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I produced a man with the help of the Lord. Next she bore his brother Abel. Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a tiller of the ground. And if you've seen enough cowboy movies, you know already we got trouble. Farmers and ranchers. One of them builds fences, the other one hates fences. It's two different cultures we have here. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground. Nobody asked him to do this. Cain invented religion, I suppose you could say, in a way. he makes an offering to God. And please notice, there's absolutely nothing in the way of a judgment about this in the text. He just does it. Abel, little brother, sees what big brother has done, says, okay, great, me too. He brought firstlings of his flock and fat portions. And because it says firstlings and fat portions, some people think, well, of course, his offering was so much better. He brought a more worthy offering. But there's no indication that there's anything whatsoever unworthy about Cain's. That's not in the text. That's an assumption that people's minds quickly make, but it's not there. All we're told is that Abel follows suit and he makes an offering too. And he happens to offer really good stuff. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering, he had no regard. Now, the Sunday school literature I grew up with always made this a very justifiable thing because there was always something obviously defective about Cain's offering and Abel's offering is wonderful. But this is thoroughly arbitrary the way the text actually reads. God simply regard the, and the word in Hebrew is simply a word for it's a multi-purpose word in Hebrew. It's pakad. It's the word for attending to someone's suffering if they're suffering. You do something about it. You get involved in that person's life. You visit them. It's the word for visit all over the place in the Hebrew Bible. So. You know, it's like somehow or another, Abel enjoys God's favor, God's company over this. So Cain was angry, very angry, and his countenance fell. And the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry and why has your countenance fallen? Which is... what it really says is, why has your nose caught fire and what's the matter with your face? Anger in Hebrew is, the expression is for your nose to catch fire and his face is fallen. You get the picture, we've all been there. And God makes no explanation except, look, if you do what you're supposed to do, won't it work out? Won't you be accepted? And if you don't, then sin is lurking at the door. It'll try to have you, but you have to control it. Okay, here's how I try to at least teach my students to understand what's going on here. How do you know if God is attending to your offerings or not? In the Sunday school literature when I was a little boy, I still remember there were two guys, each with an altar, and one guy's smoke was going straight up into the heavens and the other was being blown away. And it was obvious that Abel's offering smoke was going straight up and Cain's was being just refused. But I don't think it was about smoke. The way you would know is whether or not you prospered. Isn't that how we automatically think? If I'm prospering, God is attending to me. If I'm not, if things are not working so well, where's God anyway? Why am I being... I mean, even Jesus asks, why have you forsaken me? Why are you no longer visiting me? What's the matter here? So, Abel is thriving. Cain is having a hard time. He's just as faithful in his offering towards God as his brother, and it's not fair. So, So what do you do if God is treating you unfairly and you're getting worked over while old teacher's pet over here is just having everything work fine? You can't get your hands on God, right? So you do the next best thing. You wring God's pet's neck, which is what happens. So God comes around, not taking a walk in the cool of the day like in the earlier story, but God shows up again. You know, if I was casting this as a play on a stage, which you can do with this particular strand of stories in Genesis, I would pick Peter Falk in Columbo. Now, where'd you say your brother? You got to have a cigar, you know. Where'd you say your brother was? I haven't seen your brother in a while. Tell me again. Playing dumb, right? That's what God does here. Well, I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? Of course, the human beings had been commanded to till and to keep. And the verb here is the same. To keep the creatures and everything else. But it doesn't say you need to be your brother's keeper. That's not in any of the earlier charges. So Cain kind of rightly says, you know, I got things to keep. I take care of my land. Am I supposed to keep my brother too? Not in my job description. But God says, what have you done? Your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground. And now you are cursed from the ground. Your relationship to the ground will now be wrecked. So you see what we've got here so far? We've got another instance of deciding you're smarter than God. And you're going to fix things. You're going to change the world the way it's supposed to be. God comes and discovers it. And God responds with curse. Only now, what we've got turned loose in the world, like in the first story we had nakedness turned loose in the world, now we've got vengeance. We're two generations into our story, and already we've got the problem of vengeance. Now, of course, ever since we were kids, we always wondered, who's Cain afraid of? But we're not supposed to ask that, so we won't. Obviously, I mean, I'm kidding here. Obviously, the story sort of assumes at least a somewhat populated world. But in any case, God takes care of the problem of vengeance with another provisional solution, a mark on Cain, so that God has exclusive rights to taking care of the problem of vengeance. It does not belong to human beings. So it's the same outline. Sin, discovery by God, curse of the perpetrators, and provisional solution. Then we're going to skip some stuff. We got the beginnings of the various kinds of civilization that come from the children of Cain, and eventually we got, you know, Seth, the third child born to Adam and Eve. Then we get a genealogy in chapter 5, which is the equivalent genealogy of many ancient civilizations who had genealogies like this that proved that their people went back to the beginning. If you think some of these guys in Genesis 5 lived a long time, you should read the Babylonian king list that goes back to the creation. And people lived 75,000 years. So Methuselah was just a kid, you know. But then we get to the next great story. And this is a long and a complicated one. The ones we've been looking at so far are from a strata of the Pentateuchal stories that in the classic hypothesis about how these things were formed came from the same hand, the so-called Yahwist source, the one that calls God Yahweh. The flood story here is a complex thing with two or three layers to it. We're not going to try to sort that all out, and we're going to do a kind of hit-and-run version on this. But what we have here, I want you to see, is basically the same outline here. Only now things have sort of gone, we might say, cosmic. This is no longer the story of someone's wrongdoing, but we got everybody involved now. When people began to multiply on the face of the ground and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that they were fair and they took wives for themselves as they chose. The Lord said, my spirit shall not abide in them forever. Their flesh, their days shall be 120. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and afterwards when the sons of God mated with the daughters of humans. These were the great heroes, you know, about of old. And the Lord saw that the wickedness of humankind was great in the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of their hearts was evil continually, and the Lord was sorry. And the word literally there is repented. God repents of having made humankind on the earth. So if you ever wondered if God is absolutely unchangeable, here's evidence to the contrary. God has a change of heart. What a bad idea to have done that. So the Lord said, I'll nuke them. Blot them out. Together with the animals. Everything, because I'm sorry I made them. Sin, now all over the place, and God's observation of it, and a declaration already of curse. But then we get the hint of a provisional solution. We'll save, can't quite bear to destroy everything. We'll save one specimen, one family, one ark's worth for starting over. So then we get the great curse acted out, the flood. And if you, somebody gave me Bill Cosby's Noah CD for Christmas. I hadn't heard it in many, many years. I should have brought that with me. What was I thinking? So anyway, finally the flood subsides. The human beings are able, you know, Noah and his family are able to get out of the boat. They first light a fire and offer a sacrifice. And by the way, if you really want to understand something else about this story, you need to know that this story is told in the face of a rival story very much like it that the Babylonians told. The Babylonians also had a story about God creating human beings on the earth, not made from precisely the same stuff as the Hebrew Bible story, but close. You know, the Babylonians said that the human beings were made from dust, but not mixed with the breath of God, rather mixed with warrior blood, the blood of a warrior god, whom the gods who made the human beings killed, and they took some of his blood, this warrior god, to make the human beings. And by the way, the human beings were made in that story as slaves, because the gods had made this platform and put all these plants and stuff on it and animals, and then they realized, oh no, someone has to take care of this. We don't want to. So they made the human beings to be slaves to take care of the place. And they made them out of dust and warrior blood. And then instead of taking care of the place, all they did was fight. Which is the Babylonian story that explains why human beings do nothing but fight all the time. because that's how they're made. There are in fact truest to their essence when they're fighting. But the gods get sick of all the racket of this fighting in the Babylonian epic, so they decide to flood them out, just exactly like this story. In the Babylonian story, there's a goddess who has fallen in love with one of the human beings named Utnapishtim, and secretly clues him in what's going on, tells him to build an ark, and he saves himself, and he comes out of the ark at the end, just like the Hebrew Bible story, and he lights a fire because he hasn't had a hot meal in a long time. He didn't want to burn his boat up. So he lights a fire and cooks himself a hot meal. The gods smell it and they are furious. Somebody escaped. And they spend the rest of history, if you will, is the gods trying to track down the human beings to kill them. And it's human beings' job to escape the malignancy or the malignant intentions of the gods. And that's what life is to the Babylonians. Constant flight from these malevolent deities who are out to destroy us. And doesn't life look like that? You know, in a world where life expectancy is in the 30s and your children die so young and life is nasty, brutish, and short, to borrow a phrase. So the Babylonian story explained the world very well. But the Hebrew Bible says Noah built this ark. Noah got out of the ark. He built this fire, sacrificed an animal. And what does God do? God does not get angry. God takes a big whiff of that, says, oh my God, now I remember why I made these people. I sort of like this business of being paid attention to. This is good. It's not good to be alone. And so God says, you know, I'm never going to do that again. I will never again curse the ground, because if nothing else, it didn't help a thing. And God says in verses 21 and following, when the Lord smelled the pleasing odor, God said in his heart, I'll never again curse the ground because of humankind. And not only that, but please notice the inclination of their hearts is evil from their youth, and the flood didn't fix that. We're now post-flood, and we still got the same thing. And as we'll see shortly, of course, Noah will prove it very quickly. We get a second Garden of Eden story with the abuse of vegetables. This time, Noah using them to make fermented stuff and gets drunk. And what do we have? A nakedness problem, right? So we start all over with the same shenanigans that we had before, so you can nuke them, God sees, and it doesn't help a thing. Not only that, God likes that stuff of human beings paying attention. So God decides curse doesn't work. And it's not like this is the end of curse in the Bible, obviously. There's all kinds of that. But it does not work as the ultimate solution to what's the matter with human beings. And so God says, I'll never do that again. I will never again curse the whole earth. So when things go awry once more with Noah and thereafter, we need to look for God to behave differently. You know, we have a different kind of provisional solution this time. We have a complicated one. God saves one specimen of human beings for starting over, but now we've got a promise to go with it as well, that this will, you know, we have to find a new answer to, you know, cursing didn't help a thing anywhere along the line. Well, so then we get more genealogies and so forth, and then we get basically a populated world, and get again post-flood, and then we get to chapter 11, where we have one more story from this so-called Jacquist strata, the oldest strata of the Pentateuch. And this is another story on which we could spend a long, long time. It's rich and it's funny and it's perplexing, and you can debate it for hours, some of its implications. The whole earth had one language and the same words. And they migrated from the east and came upon a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, "Come, let's make bricks and burn them thoroughly." They had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar, and they said, "Come, let's build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let's make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we shall be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth." So, you know, it's more than just building the biggest tower ever. It's trying to determine their own destiny. And actually to, you know, in a sense, to storm the heavens and to take over, to be in charge of their own lives. It's a version of the playing God that happened in all the other stories. So it's in effect a repetition of this, the sin. In verse 5, God shows up, somewhat like in both Genesis 3 and 4. God came down to see the city which the mortals had built and said, "Get a load of this. Oh boy, they are one people with one language. This is only the beginning of what they'll cook up. Nothing they propose to do will be impossible." And you can almost see God looking slightly silent. "Let's go down there and screw up their language." Because that's part of their power. They all understand each other. They all have the same words for everything. "Let's go down there and make a mess of their language, and they'll never be the same." So there you have the discovery, and in effect a kind of curse, although, you know, it's really hard to say that, because you don't, you know, if you really understand, and they did by now, you know, who's ever writing this understands language very well. There's a cleverness of language about this literature that's remarkable. And so I cannot believe that people who wrote this didn't understand already then that the diversity of languages is not only a curse, but a gift. I mean, there are things you can say and describe in any language that defy translation, because there's something that the words of one language capture in its description that are finally not accessible in another language, at least not without a paragraph or two, and you usually don't have time for that. So you know, a language is a bit of the way that generates actual perception and seeing what's there. I mean, at least that's one theory about language. So language is a great, you know, the diversity of languages is a great blessing, because people who speak one language can literally see things that I can't because of my language and what my language teaches me to find in an object out there in my experience. You know, and it, just as an example, the Hebrew language here, lots of you know this, the Hebrew language doesn't have any tenses. Stuff's either happening or not. You know, wouldn't you have loved to have that as a language so that you didn't have to learn all the different kinds of tenses? As opposed to, for example, the Greek language in which the New Testament is written, which just has, you know, more than a dozen ways to distinguish time. Perfect, pluperfect, and all these things that we know of because we inherited that way of using tenses. Well, what those represent are radically different ways of understanding reality. And the Greeks did it with all kinds of distinctions about time that the Hebrews paid no attention to, or at least no obvious attention to. But you could see things about reality, if that was your language, that you can't see if you insist on breaking time down into many, 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 many different distinguishable types. So anyway, you could say this is curse, but you could say this is blessing. But what it does is scatters people over the face of the earth into the what we would now today call tribes, I think, not just nations, but into the groups of people that simply cannot abide each other, cannot understand each other, and because they cannot understand each other in their differences, they can also not live together. So this is the world we know, the world that's broken in multiple ways, including broken up by all these tribal groups, each with their own language and the cultures that derive from them. Then we get more genealogies. And then in the middle of this genealogical stuff, well, not the middle, it's at the end, but out of this whole hodgepodge now of these groups, in total arbitrary fashion, chapter 12, verse 1, God says to someone from one of these groups, you. Abram and Sarah, you're it. Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I'll make you a great nation and bless you to make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. One who curses you, I'll curse. But in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed, is the way that the NRSV translated. So Abram goes. Now, what this is more, at this point, than a provisional solution. The way I understand this as the conclusion to Genesis 1 to 11 and what we've witnessed in this sequence of stories is, this is more than just, okay, we're going to try to keep this show on the road now. The way I read this is, this people here that's charged with blessing is God's last hope for the world. Because God has tried everything else. God has tried curses. God has tried all this stuff, and nothing has worked, and nothing has helped. God is going to try blessing. And if blessing doesn't work, you know, there's only one other genuine alternative, and that would be to go ahead and repent once more of the whole thing, and only this time not save a sample. So, in the way I understand this, this whole story together is the answer to the question that Jewish children could ask. This is what you taught them in catechism class. Not that they were doing catechism in bar mitzvah as we understand it. They were doing catechism. There's instruction all over the Hebrew Bible. When the children ask this, this is what you say. What do these stones mean here by the Jordan? Well, when the children ask, what is the point of our being the chosen people? The answer is, we're God's last hope for the world. If we don't get blessing worked in the world, if we're not a blessing to all the families of the earth, the other option is wipe out the whole thing. I mean, imagine the stakes of being that people. You know, this is what the prophets later on have in mind when they call on Israel to be faithful. It wasn't just that they were legalists. If it wasn't for clinging to this promise of God, the alternative is unthinkable. we cannot give up. But of course, it's not merely Israel that cannot give up. It's God. And Israel knows that if they are God's last hope for the world, then God can't give up on them either. So at this point, the way the whole thing works, God and Israel, I mean, this isn't the greatest language, but they're stuck with each other. Once God makes this move, they are bound. Neither can give up, because the alternative for either one to give up on this relationship is beyond comprehension. So God ties God's self to a clay pot and says, "This is where my treasure is, and I can't let go." And of course, Moses and all kinds of people are going to use this later on. They're going to say, "God, well, sure, God, go ahead. If you really need to do away with us, go ahead, but think about the consequences. You know, not only what will the neighbors say," that's all over the Psalms of Lament, you know, "but you promised, and these are the stakes. Do you really want that?" So you know, there's an intensity here of this relationship. I sometimes think of it in terms of that old joke about the people on their 50th or 60th wedding anniversary when they were asked, "Did you ever think of divorce?" And one of them says, "Divorce, no. Murder, yes." You know, they can't divorce. And we'll, you know, we're going to see later this, well, later on in my Bible studies anyway, if you're here, some of the times that this happens, that God cannot give up on his people. So, 2 minutes for questions. You know, to me, this is the first cracked pot. Yeah?
Just a comment. I was working in India many years ago and was there on the first Sunday in Advent. And it, of course, wasn't a Sabbath on Sunday, so as we went to the church, it was all the ordinary rag sellers and so on as we went along. But we got in the church, and it was very festive, ready. But the pastor got up for the sermon the first Sunday in Advent, and his text was, what was it, Genesis 3:9. And we thought, what is he doing talking about God saying to Adam, "Where are you?" But his whole thing was, this is what set apart the Christians, that the Christians knew that God comes to them and seeks them out, where out of his culture of the Hindus, you had to work and find merit and find God, work your way to God. But the Christian knew that God comes and seeks us out. That was his take on it.
Okay.
And that goes along with your relationship, that God built the relationship and not people.
Yeah, thank you. Yes?
I have a question about the Babylonian versus the Hebrew stories. Did one kind of come before the other, or did they kind of arise at the same time?
Well, the Babylonian civilization is older than the Hebrew civilization, and in fact, Abram and Sarai come from Ur of the Chaldees, which is from the old Babylonian Empire. And so the ordinary assumption is that the Babylonian story predates the Hebrew version, and the Hebrew version is a response to it. I mean, the Hebrew version says, no, not. We're not made to fight. We're made, the breath of God is the stuff of justice and mercy. We're dust with the capacity of God's own justice and mercy. And God does not hate us. God loves the smell of our sacrifice. God is not a malignant force that wants to wipe us out, but God is you know, for us, not against us. So in, you know, at various points, and this story got reworked, of course, in different ages, as in Genesis 1, which is late, in order to say no to the Babylonian view of reality, because the Babylonians conquered the Israelites and told them, "See, we're right, and we win, you lose." And in the face of of the Babylonian theology, the Israelites asserted their own theology about God. That's how I understand it.
Is the God in Israel stuck to each other, still in play in Israel and politics today?
Well, I never heard anybody talk exactly like that, but you know, if you, I presume among observant and Orthodox and the truly religious Jews of Israel, this is a piece, this ancient piece of theology of being the chosen ones, is still alive and well. The question is, and this is what we're going to address tomorrow. The question is, if you're supposed to be a blessing to all the families of the earth, what does that look like? Yeah. How do you bring blessing to all the rest of the earth? You know, but the point, part of the point is, you don't live for yourself. This is a people whose role in the world is not to live for themselves, but their whole purpose of existence is to live for others. The reason they are God's people is because God has this thing to do for everybody else who's in such a mess. That's why I call them the crackpot full of God's mercy and reconciliation. God's trying to work on the problem of all this alienation. And how do you do that? And that's what we're going to work on tomorrow. What does blessing look like? How would you know it if you saw it? Okay? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.